The Heretic's Forfeit, a tale of jealousy, murder, and revenge, written and performed by Paul Francis Matthews. Episode 3. The thumping on the huge front door of the Widow Grimshaw's house was so heavy and insistent that it threatened to dislodge the door from its hinges. A servant holding a candlestick hurried down the hallway.
"I come! I come!"
He unbolted the door and Marlowe charged in.
"Where is thy mistress?"
"She's still abed, sire."
"Well, wake her and tell her that Christopher Marlowe would have a word."
The servant led Marlowe to a room off the hallway and then went to fetch his mistress. The room was cluttered with all kinds of strange occult gewgaws, corn dollies, monkey paws, a human fetus pickled in a jar. Marlowe's eye was caught by a small bottle sitting on the shelf. It was labelled Liquor of Hemlock Root. In that very instant, a diabolical plan hatched, fully formed in his mind. He swiped the small bottle from the shelf and put it in his pocket. The Widow Grimshaw entered in extremely high dudgeon.
"Master Marlowe, what has occasioned this uproar? Art thou still yet drunk? Go to, I say, and quit my house at once."
The old woman took a step back. 2 days previously, a gang of youths had cornered a stray wolfhound in an alley just off St. Martin's Lane. Their intention was to kick and pummel the stricken beast to death. It was all splendid fun, and a large crowd had gathered to watch, among them the Widow Grimshaw. The expression on Marlowe's face just at that moment made him look exactly like that wretched cur, for in his eyes there blazed a wild, desperate rage born of absolute terror.
"What meant you when you said, 'Christopher Marlowe, thou hast written thy last play'?"
The old woman hesitated for a few seconds and then said,
"Nothing."
Marlowe drew his sword.
"If thou dost not tell me truly what was meant by it, I swear by all the furies that I shall paint thy house's walls with thy witch's blood. Tell me, so thou shalt be dead."
The words were out before she could stop them. She made an odd little clawing motion with her right hand, as if she was trying to catch them in midair and cram them back into her mouth. For his part, Marlowe felt as if he had been hit in the chest with a sledgehammer. He reeled back in shock, the wind knocked out of him.
"Soon I shall be dead?"
The Widow Grimshaw slowly nodded her head. Marlowe could feel a splinter of ice working its way up his spine.
"You lie."
"If I do lie, then whate'er I say is of no consequence to thee. There is the door, Master Marlowe, so take thy leave and I'll go back to bed."
Marlowe didn't move. He was paralysed with indecision. The old bitch must be lying, he thought. But why should she? Simply to frighten him? And she had been right about Shakespeare. "If I am soon to die, then how soon? And where am I to die, and what is the cause?"
"To know that, I perforce must consult the cards again."
"Then do it."
The old woman walked across the room and sat down at a small table. Marlowe sat opposite her. She opened a drawer and took out the cards.
"First, cross my palm with silver."
"Ere I cross thy palm with silver, hag, I'll cross thy throat with the edge of my blade. Deal the cards."
The old woman dealt the cards. She stared at them intently for a few moments.
"A house by the river. Above the door there hangs the painted sign of a bull's head."
"I know the place. 'Tis a tavern I oft frequent. I am to dine there tomorrow night." "Am I also to die there?"
"You are there with three others. There is a quarrel. A one-eyed man and another bearing a scar draw their weapons. Thou art overpowered, and then thou art murdered."
"Might the cards be wrong?"
"The cards are never wrong."
"So, now I know the time, the place, and the perpetrators of the fatal deed." He took some loose change from his pocket and tossed it onto the table. "Here's thy silver, old woman, and my thanks. To be forewarned is to be forearmed." He rose from his chair and headed towards the door, but before he could get to it, the old woman ran over and grabbed him by the arm.
"Thou canst not change what the future holds for thee. Thy fate is as fixed and immutable as are the stars in the shady canopy of night. What must be, and what is to come has been writ by the hand of God."
"Then I shall unwrite it,"
snarled Marlowe as he threw the old woman to the floor. The Bull's Head Tavern, Deptford, the following night. The tavern stood all alone, as if other buildings were too ashamed to be seen with it. It was a cold and filthy night. The lowering clouds threatened the very devil of a thunderstorm. The river rats, skulking in their river rat holes, their little river rat whiskers twitching, could feel it coming in the air. The only other creature in the vicinity was a dark horse tethered to a hitching post. The tavern had only one customer tonight, Christopher Marlowe, sitting at a table by the fireplace. He had just eaten a simple but delicious dinner of a hen boiled with leeks, followed by an egg custard for pudding, all washed down with a quart jug of the excellent house ale. He was now amusing himself with a pack of cards that he had newly acquired. They were the same as the ones the Widow Grimshaw utilized for her clairvoyance, but he wasn't attempting to divine the future. For a start, he didn't know what the spooky pictures in the cards signified, so instead he was playing Snap, which was proving to be terribly frustrating as no two cards were identical. The innkeeper was sitting behind the bar, gently dozing. He was suddenly startled awake by the door crashing open. Two men strode in, their heavy boots clattering on the bare floorboards. The innkeeper immediately sensed trouble, but Marlowe didn't bat an eyelid. The first man was Robert Poley. His head was bandaged. The second man was the man that Robert Poley worked for. His name was Ingram Fraser. He had gold rings on every finger, a mouthful of gold teeth, and the patch that covered his left eye was made of silk embroidered with gold thread. Poley hung slightly back near the door. He would let his boss do all the talking.
"Master Marlowe," said Fraser.
Marlowe ignored Fraser. He continued playing his futile game of Snap.
"Master Marlowe."
"Why, if it isn't Master Ingram Fraser. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you come in. And I see that Master Poley is with you also. How's your head, Robert? I do hope it's healed up." The fire in the grate flared as a gust of wind howled down the chimney.
"Ooh, 'tis a wild night, is it not, gentlemen?" But Messrs. Fraser and Poley hadn't come to chat about the weather.
"I have come for my money."
"Oh, what money would's that be?"
"The money thou hast owed me this last 4 months."
"Oh, that money."
"Here is the reckoning."
Fraser nodded to Poley, who took an invoice from his pocket. He walked across the room and placed it on Marlowe's table. Poley walked back to the door. Marlowe glanced at the invoice. "A tidy sum."
"Well, Master Marlowe, wilt thou pay the reckoning?"
By way of reply, Marlowe crumpled up the invoice and threw it on the fire. He went back to dealing out the cards. Tut, tut, tut. The cards foretell a bloody outcome.
"Aye, sirrah,"
said Fraser, drawing his sword.
"For thee."
Poley also drew his sword, and then both men charged across the room. In one fluid movement, Marlowe dropped the cards, picked up two loaded crossbows from either side of his chair, aimed them at Fraser and Poley, and fired. The metal-tipped bolts slammed into Fraser and Poley at a speed of over 400 feet per second. Fraser was struck right between the eyes and was dead before his body hit the floor. Poley was struck in the right shoulder, the bolt slicing through the trapezoid artery and thus rendering useless his sword arm. Before Poley could make a break for the door, Marlowe quickly tossed aside one of the crossbows and reloaded the other, which he now aimed squarely at Poley's chest. Poley wasn't dead because of poor marksmanship on Marlowe's part, but because Marlowe didn't want Poley dead just yet. There was something he really needed to know.
"Do you believe in God, Robert?"
"What?"
"'Tis a simple question. Do you believe in God?"
"Aye, I believe in God. Doesn't everyone?"
"Well, perhaps not everyone. So as you believe in God, it follows, does it not, that you likewise believe that there is a devil, and also that there are angels and demons in heaven and hell?"
"Aye, it surely does follow."
"Very soon I will kill you, Robert, and when that is done and thou art stone cold dead, whither shalt thy soul fly? To heaven or to hell?"
"To hell, of course."
Of course. It was Marlowe's granite-hard conviction that religion was a parcel of complete tosh and piffle. He could understand its attraction for the pious. They would be rewarded in heaven. But what was the point of religion for pox-scarred sons of whores like Poley? His reward was hell, as he had just so candidly and emphatically admitted. So how did Master Poley feel about his imminent demise and subsequent eternal damnation? This was what Marlowe really needed to know.
So tell me, Robert, and I promise that this is my last question, and I shall not detain thee further, but now that thou hast but a brief moment to live, and then thou must be damned perpetually, does the prospect affright thee especially?
I must atone for my sins.
Pauly said this with a little half-smile and a shrug, and the little half-smile and the shrug had said it all. Hell may have been his reward, but Master Pauly didn't mind one little bit because he'd willingly met the cost of admission and was now going to pay the reckoning. Hee-ho. His curiosity satisfied, Marlowe raised the crossbow ever so slightly until it was aimed at Pauly's forehead.
I would thank you, Master Pauly, to convey my warmest regards to Great Lucifer, Chief Lord and Regent of Perpetual Night. Oh, and also a request of his Satanic Majesty that he keeps a seat warm for me at his top table. Fare thee well, Robert.
Master Robert Pauly, duly dispatched, Marlowe stood up, calmly placed the crossbows on the table, put on his tunic, then gathered up the cards and walked over to the bar.
A bottle of your most decent claret, please, innkeeper.
The innkeeper didn't respond. He was staring slack-jawed at the two dead bodies and the slick of blood that was slowly oozing like a barrel of spilt burgundy-coloured treacle across the floor.
Oh, never mind. I'll just help myself.
Marlowe went behind the bar and selected from the rack a bottle of the 86. He left some cash in the till to pay for it, he wasn't a complete cad, and then he took a little time to survey his grisly handiwork.
Well, gentlemen, the cards did foretell a bloody outcome.
And the cards are never wrong. Marlowe left the building. Outside, the very devil of a thunderstorm was raging. A flash of lightning rent the sky, which, if one were gullible enough to believe in such things, Marlowe fancied to be a sign of the omniscient deity's displeasure. He found it all terribly amusing. An apt quote from a play he'd recently read came to mind.
Blow, winds, and crack your cheeks. Rage, blow!
He took the tarot cards from his pocket and hurled them into the teeth of the gale.
So much for fate and the hand of God. For what is God compared to me? I am Christopher Marlowe. I curse God.
Marlowe put the bottle of wine into a saddlebag, then mounted his dark horse and rode off at full pelt towards the hall at Gray's Inn. His evening's bloody work was not yet done. It was standing room only at the hall at Gray's Inn for the second performance of the Comedy of Errors, the hilarious romp by the hot new writer in town, William Shakespeare. Or was it spelt Shakespeare? No one was quite sure. The play had come to its happy end. Antipholus and Dromio of Ephesus and Antipholus and Dromio of Syracuse, a pair of identical twins, separated in childhood by the cruel hand of fate, were at last reunited.
We came into the world like brother and brother, and now let's go hand in hand, not one before another.
With the rest of the cast gathered around them, and every face wreathed in smiles, both sets of long-lost twins clasped hands together. The end. The call boy and his mate, grinning from ear to ear, tripped merrily onto the stage and drew the curtains. When they reopened them and the cast took their bow, the reaction from the packed house was immediate and tumultuous. Soon the cry went up for the author, and the ovation Shakespeare received when he came on almost took the roof off. And standing right in the middle of the front row, leading the applause and beaming with proprietorial pride, was Richard Burbage. Earlier in the evening, while Christopher Marlowe was busy slaughtering Robert Pauly and Ingram Fraser, Burbage and Shakespeare had shaken hands on a deal for Shakespeare to write the play that would open Burbage's new theatre, The Globe, at Southwark. This was just the start of something fantastic. Shakespeare had just exited the stage door and was busy tying a scarf round his neck to keep out the biting cold, a nice woolly scarf it was too, knitted by the little woman back in Stratford, when Marlowe crept up behind him and put a hand on his shoulder. Shakespeare nearly had a heart attack. "Did I fright thee, Master Shakespeare?"
"No, not at all, Master Marlowe."
"I rather fear I did, but no matter. The play went well tonight, I hear."
"It went very well."
"I also heard the good news."
"The good news?"
"Burbage has asked thee to write a play for his new theatre at Southwark, The Globe." Shakespeare was stunned. How the hell did Marlowe know about this? Marlowe read Shakespeare's mind. "You're asking yourself how I know this. I know everything, because I have spies everywhere." He wasn't joking. He really did. "So, Shakespeare, let us celebrate thy good fortune." Marlowe produced the bottle of fine claret that he'd obtained from the Bull's Head Tavern. Shakespeare's heart sank. He had already this evening resisted attempts by the cast of the play and Richard Burbage to lure him out on the raz. He was shattered.
"Oh, Master Marlowe, I do fear I had a surfeit of wine t'other night. And pardon, but I am sore aweary and needs must to my bed."
"Oh, you'll be lying tucked up in your bed soon enough," thought Marlowe. A couple of nights ago, this shy country mouse could hardly wait to raise a glass with him, but now that Marlowe had served his purpose, namely introducing him to Richard Burbage in the cream of the London theatre scene, he was giving him the brush off. Come to think of it, Shakespeare had acted as if he had no idea who Burbage was, but Richard Burbage's family actually came from Stratford-upon-Avon, Shakespeare's hometown. How the hell could he not have heard of him? Marlowe felt an overwhelming desire to whip out his sword and eviscerate the smarmy little lying fucker right there and then. But instead he smiled sweetly and said, "Oh, come, come, Master Shakespeare, where's the harm in just one little glass? Please, please, one little glass?"
"Oh, very well, Master Marlowe, but just the one."
Once they'd arrived at Shakespeare's lodgings in Bishopsgate, Marlowe made himself comfortable by lounging on the bed, cradling the bottle of claret in his lap while Shakespeare sorted out the wine glasses. "Who's that?" said Marlowe, pointing at the skull on the writing desk. "A friend of thine?"
"Yes, a fellow of infinite jest. He's dead now."
"Well, he would be." Shakespeare put the glasses on the bedside table, then went over to the writing desk and picked up the skull.
"I have a play in mind, which one day I will write, and it shall have a scene therein where the young hero, in a graveyard, holds discourse with certain others whilst holding a skull thus."
Shakespeare struck a pose, holding the skull at arm's length and staring into its eyes. It was a striking visual image, but God only knows what it was supposed to mean. That Shakespeare was a genius was indisputable. Marlowe had seen the evidence, but he also seemed to be completely away with the fairies. Interesting. And what, may I inquire, shall this play be about?"
"In brevi, it shall concern itself with a young man who cannot decide."
"On what?"
"On anything."
"Ah, vacillation, the abiding sin of the weak-willed. Once thy course is set, never waver from it. Never." Marlowe opened the bottle and poured the wine. He handed a glass to Shakespeare. "Here's to thee, William Shakespeare, and long may our newfound friendship endure."
"And here's to thee, Christopher Marlowe."
"Oh, call me Kit."
"Call me Will."
Shakespeare drank from his glass. He grimaced slightly. "Is the wine not your liking, Will?"
No, it is a little strong, that is all."
Shakespeare decided that he didn't want any more wine. He went to put the glass back down on the bedside table, yet somehow, and even though he was standing right next to it, he contrived to miss the bedside table completely and drop the glass on the floor. How could he have been so clumsy? But the explanation was really quite simple. The bedside table had moved across the floor by about 12 feet. The rest of the furniture had also radically shifted position. How had that happened? And then, with a sickening lurch, the entire room suddenly expanded outwards until the walls fell away completely and disappeared. Shakespeare now found himself standing by the banks of a river. He looked at his own reflection in the water, but it wasn't water. It was blood with shards of ice floating in it. Marlowe was sitting on a boat way, way out in the middle of the river of blood and ice, and as the boat drifted further and further away, Marlowe raised his hand and waved a farewell. Marlowe caught Shakespeare as he fell. He placed him on the chair. He then proceeded to clear up the fragments of shattered glass and the spilled wine. He removed Shakespeare's clothes, folded them neatly and put them in a drawer. He then dressed Shakespeare in his nightshirt, lifted him over to the bed and tucked him in. He crouched down by the side of the bed and stroked Shakespeare's face. He spoke softly to him, as if to a lover. "I' the morrow they'll pronounce you dead, and in the cold, dank earth you'll be interred. Yet it is but the mask of death you wear, a counterfeit." Marlowe held up the small bottle labelled Liquor of Hemlock Root that he'd purloined from the Widow Grimshaw's house. "This distillation has in thee a death-like sleep induced, and in Morpheus' soft embrace thou dost repose. Thou art not dead, thou livest still, and thus is my conscience salved." "Marlowe hath murdered Shakespeare?"
"Let no man say I did."
"The guilt is borne by he who hammers shut thy coffin lid." It was only after knocking loudly on the door of Shakespeare's lodgings for a good 10 minutes that Nick Bottom finally realised that the door was actually unlocked. He let himself in and was shocked at what he discovered.
"What, Master Shakespeare, still abed?"
After the previous night's performance, Shakespeare had requested that the cast convene this morning at Gray's Inn to re-rehearse some scenes. That all the scenes were the ones featuring Nick Bottom did not overly dismay Nick Bottom. As far as Nick Bottom was concerned, if the other performers were ruining Nick Bottom's scenes, then they would just have to keep rehearsing and rehearsing until they jolly well got them right. The cast had been patiently waiting for their director for most of the morning, so when Nick Bottom was dispatched to find him, and subsequently discovered that he was still at his lodgings and in his bed, fast asleep, he was more than a little annoyed.
"The cock has long since crowed, and all of us that are gathered at the Gray's Inn have been awaiting thy pleasure this last hour and a half, so rouse thyself."
But Shakespeare did not awaken.
"Rouse thyself, I say!"
When Nick Bottom touched Shakespeare's arm and felt how cold it was, he immediately realised something was desperately wrong. He put his ear to Shakespeare's chest, but there was no heartbeat. He grabbed Shakespeare by the shoulders and shook him roughly.
"Will! Will! Will!"
There was nothing to be done. Shakespeare was gone. And in the corner of the small room, the wooden chest that had contained Shakespeare's plays lay empty, its treasure looted. The next morning at Billingsgate Cemetery, it was cold and raining, as it always seems to be on days like these when someone who has died too young is buried. Marlowe, Burbage, Kidd, Spencer and Edward Alleyne were all in attendance, as were the Comedy of Errors cast. Richard Burbage was particularly distressed.
"Oh, sorrowful day. E'en the heavens do weep."
"He died too young,"
said Thomas Kidd.
"And if he'd lived, who knows what he may have achieved,"
said Edmund Spencer.
"Might he have become one day as great a writer as thee, Marlowe?"
A withering glower from Marlowe forced Edmund Spencer to backtrack rapidly.
"Oh, perhaps not."
The grave diggers lowered Shakespeare's coffin into the ground and then started shoveling dirt on top of it, blissfully unaware that they were burying him alive. Marlowe wiped away a tear. "There is an inn nearby, to which let us forthwith convey ourselves, and on this mournful day we shall there balm our aching hearts with a healing cup."
"Good idea, Kit,"
said Edward Alleyne as a cart loaded with barrels of lampreys packed in ice trundled by.
"This place is freezing cold, and doth stink something horrible of fish."
And as Shakespeare's friends, colleagues, and brief acquaintances solemnly sloped off to the pub, Marlowe sidled up to Burbage.
"Well, Richard, it seems that thou art deficient of a play."
"What play would that be?"
"The play Shakespeare was to write for your new theatre at Southwark. The Globe."
"Oh, yes, that play. I had, in my grief, forgot.
Well, he can hardly write it now, can he? What with him being dead.
No, he cannot. Yes, the Globe shall be want of a play, and it opens soon.
Perchance I can help.
Oh?
I have, as luck would have it, just newly completed a play.
'Tis a slight thing, a comedy. Oh, a comedy would be most fitting. I prithee, Marlowe, when can I see thy new play?
It shall be in thine hands as soon as I have made a fair copy of it.
What is its title?
Its title is A Midsummer Night's Dream.
And what is it about?
In brevi, it is about some fairies.
Billingsgate Fish Market, from Wikipedia, the Free Encyclopedia. The first reference to the fish market at Billingsgate Wharf, close to Lower Thames Street, is in a 1577 chronicle by Raphael Holinshed. The writer George Orwell worked at the market in the 1930s, as did the Cray twins in the 1950s. Although the fish market was relocated to Poplar in 1972, the area has recently enjoyed something of a resurgence. Plans are underway for the construction of the Billingsgate Tower, a project jointly financed by the Sultanate of Oman and the People's Republic of China. Once completed, this inverted V-shaped building, already nicknamed the Fang, is sure to become a startling addition to the London skyline. And at 309.75 metres, it will be 6 inches taller than the Shard. If the angle of the Tex 220 pneumatic rock breaker's drill bit had been just a little less acute, instead of planing harmlessly across the top of the coffin lid, it would have pierced right through it. And William Shakespeare, buried alive for more than 4 centuries, would have died in his sleep. The end of episode 3 of The Heretic's Forfeit.